I'd like to just go ahead and call the Rules Committee of the Board of Psychologists Examiners to order. Ms. Jones, could you do the roll call, please?
Yes, ma'am. Dr. Malott?
Here.
Dr. Bohansky?
Present.
And Dr. Flowers?
Present.
You have a quorum. Thank you. And we also have Jeannie Han joining us.
Who?
Jeannie Han.
I'm sorry, I missed that. Okay. Oh, yeah. Okay. Ms. Han is joining us. Thank you, Ms. Han, for being here.
My pleasure.
Okay. I'd like to go to approval of the minutes. If you all need a minute to look at it, please do, and then we will I'll entertain a motion to approve.
Yes, I make a motion that the minutes be approved.
Second. Do I hear a second?
Second.
Okay, all in favor say aye.
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 Okay, motion approved. We're done with approving the minutes. I'd like to move to item number four, discussion, consideration, and possible action pertaining to the five-year rule review. I think under this item, many of us have been looking at different rule items, so including, you know, some of the items that we considered last time, and I'd like to kind of go through it systematically as presented and when we were doing, you know, all of us decided to take different sections. Mm-hmm. So the first thing that I'd like to talk about is the PLUS application, which is offered by the ASPPB. And one consideration that I want to bring up is whether we should kind of shorten that section and just say an application, you know, and just keep it kind of general and just keeping the first paragraph, an application as approved by the board or the PLUS application, and or the PLUS application, because I'm not sure how it's working out in jurisdictions, but I know there's been, we may have to maybe add a couple of questions that would be unique to Arizona. I'm not sure how that would work, but that would cover us either way. So, and I know Ms. Han is here, Jeannie's here, and she can maybe recommend language to capture that information. And so I'm interested in knowing other people's thoughts on that.
We looked at this before in several meetings. Gosh, back when Cindy was here, and we thought we could probably get rid of four or five pages of rules if we just said that we would accept the PLUS application or an application acceptable to the board. And I think that...
Not even use the word PLUS, just say an application acceptable to the board?
Well, what I'd like to do is build into it, and maybe it should be an application acceptable to the board or ASPPB. What I'm trying to do is get into the language, essentially something that now matches the governor's idea, that if you're licensed in another state, that we're looking at accepting the license here. Well, if there's a interstate application, one that's approved for use in all jurisdictions, that's one that we should specifically say is acceptable to us.
Madam Chair, committee members, and Ms. Han, maybe you can give us some guidance. Could we simply put on a form approved by the board?
Yes, and I'm working with other agencies for moving to make this same kind of simplification, taking out all this detail, because it frequently leads to the application form being inconsistent with rule when you put all this detail in rule. We could do, We could have made this amendment, for instance, in 203 by simply striking in subsection A the words "and provide the following." And then it would say a form available from the board office and on its website.
I like that. Let's do it.
Do we just need to take off the signature part?
Do we? I don't know. You tell me.
Well, the online applications that we have.
Mm-hmm. Do you have an electronic signature? I mean, agencies, I mean, not agents. I sometimes make electronic signatures, and so I'm just wondering whether you'd have that capability.
I think they just push a yes or no button. They attest to it, but they're not actually doing like a DocuSign signature on it.
Okay.
And basically their yes signifies that this is in lieu of a handwritten.
So whatever wording, Madam Chair, committee members, so I like Jeannie's idea of striking after "and provide the following." If y'all are acceptable with that, and then we can work on the attestation.
Strike how far?
All of A.
So what page is that on? I'm in the PDF copy.
Yeah, so it looks like page, half of page 14, all of 15, all of 16, and half of 17.
And then we need to...
Okay, 14, 15. So what about... okay, an individual wishes to be licensed as a psychologist will submit an application and provide the following. So personal information can go. Then A, you have holds a certificate of professional qualification. So that would just come in the application approved by the board.
Yes.
Correct?
Yes, it would be listed on your app.
Okay. Irrelevant. So it's basically the same app, but we are just saying in an application as approved by the board.
Yes.
Okay. So that all those questions.
Madam Chair, committee members, this is Heather. I wonder if section 8 needs to remain. It has to do with the references and what qualifications are required of the references.
Why do you think that couldn't just be on the form?
Right. We can. It would be up to the committee, but right now we require that the references be two licensed psychologists. So it would take out that requirement.
No, it wouldn't take out the requirement. It can still be on the form.
On the form.
So we could just...
Yeah, you just have the requirement on the form would say the name, position, address of two individuals to serve as references. It would be the same thing.
And they have to be licensed psychologists.
It would just be on the application.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
B and C might need to... Subsections B and C might need to remain because they are in addition to the form.
Absolutely.
Yes, we need to make sure that they're current, or if they haven't been in practice for a while, that it's the most recent time of activity.
But that could still go in the application form, the instructions.
Okay, if it is there, then that...
Yeah, so, and then the references, people will list the references, and then it will be in the application form, and then the reference form will also have that same instruction.
Okay, that should cover it.
Okay. Madam Chair, committee members, and I can certainly work on fine-tuning the B and C portions to make sure that they've covered the... And of course, Heather will help us to cover the bit, what we need to have. It's supplemental information.
Okay.
Okay. So, okay. So, well, we've addressed that particular question. So the next one actually goes right into the requirement for psychologist references. And I am wondering, you know, we received a comment from the public saying that many states don't require psychologist references. In my experience over the last, I don't know, 13 years, I think we got one letter that there was a problem, you know. But 99.9%, they basically not added to our review process. So I'm just wondering what everyone's comments are on that particular item.
My own feeling. Go ahead.
It's like application or references for internship. Every one of them is glowing because you only ask references who like you. And they've been found to be useless in terms of our evaluative process for damn near everything.
I'm wondering, I'm looking for the reference in the statute, and I'm not, is it in the statute, Ms. Jones, that we require reference, and I'm not finding it.
No, I don't think it is.
Okay.
No, and that's why I
so really then it's the, kind of the pleasure of the board that we require references. So,
here, Madam Chair, I really think it ought to stay. I mean, it's very true that we don't typically choose people that dislike us, but it would be very telling if an applicant couldn't find anybody that does.
Has that ever happened?
No. It's not a popularity.
We've never denied a license or even raised unless it was out of date.
What it's done
that's never come up in 13 years.
It's caused us to get into battles over things like a school psychologist who's now upgraded to a PsyD wants to apply, and all their references are school psychologists who've known them for the past 10 years. And we say, oh, gee, you don't have any licensed psychologist in there. Why are we doing that battle? We had to make exceptions for those people.
And I mean, the reference is basically, I mean, it's kind of a checkpoint, you know? And as Dr. Bohansky said, very rarely will people ask somebody who's not going to give them at least an average reference. I know at our university, we are going through a process with many of our graduate programs, not all, where we are removing the letters of reference, again, because it really doesn't add anything to our review process for admissions, especially in non-competitive programs. And because it's a form, it's even harder. Sometimes when I do admission applications, I can read between the lines, you know, and when people write and they say like, well, you know, this person would benefit from, and then, you know, you start to think, okay, what are they trying to say? Again, but you're just, you know.
But now you're
in
analyzing
this case,
composition.
It's a form.
Madam Chair, committee members, I did do some research, and I believe I sent out a memo on this. About half of the jurisdictions do not require, it's about 50-50 on the requirement of recommendations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's about 50-50, so. Yeah, I see that in your notes, so.
Madam Chair, I'm certainly it'd be simpler if we didn't even have them do it. On the other hand, you know, if there's some outcry from the public that we're not even checking references as we would for most job applicants, then that could be criticized.
We can ask them to provide names without letters.
You know, that's a good suggestion. And if we really had a concern about an applicant, I think making a phone call would be, you know, using maybe a, or sending them a form then, you know, because we're like, we are kind of concerned about this person, you know. and then going down the step. That could be a kind of a halfway solution. So we still get reference names, and that the board reserves the right to contact references.
Madam Chair, committee members, perhaps we can work on this. I think in, Jeannie, in the five-year review, I misunderstood, or maybe I just want to clarify. We're trying to drill down on the big picture, the 40,000-foot level, not which specific things to change, well, although it provides a map for us for our next process.
I already have a note that we're going to remove a subsection, most of the detail in subsection A from the rules, and this is in that subsection. So you, as you change, the change would be made on your application form, not the rules.
Yeah, okay, so maybe we don't need to discuss this any further then. Why don't we put it as an agenda item for one of our future board meetings?
Great.
Excellent.
If it isn't statutory, then that's definitely
It's not a statutory change, nor a rule change.
So that would, yeah, that would sound very, like a really good idea.
Yeah, and that way we get feedback from, you know, the larger group, so. Okay, so moving right along. So number three, clarification regarding internships that are not AP or APIC approved, Rule 26203. So I am thinking, is that also removed as a result of removing of all these sections in the rule, because it's under number 6 on page 16. Number 5, information about their education and training.
That can still be in the application form.
So what I mean is we don't need to discuss it. It doesn't impact the rule change because we've already removed it. So I just wanted to know, Ms. Jones, what was your thought in terms of the clarification? I'm a little unsure about that one.
I'm sorry, I don't understand the question.
You indicated on the list, clarification regarding internships that are not APA or APIC approved.
Oh, that was a question that had been brought up at one of the committee or board meetings.
Uh-huh.
That the wanted to clarify what was necessary. It was just an item that was brought up for further discussion.
This is the problem that comes here is every now and then, often from NAU, we get an applicant who has created an internship and the intern turns out not to meet, the internship turns out not to meet the typical standards that APIC would require, such as having two supervisors available and having another student involved in the process. And then we're stuck making a determination whether or not this person's internship is going to count, because our rules essentially suggest it has to be APA or in line with the regulations of APIC. And some of these made up internships, which especially for students in rural areas and coming from smaller schools and in some of the specialty things like school psych, they go out and do a lot of work in a school and under a psychologist, and then we say they don't qualify.
And Madam Chair, committee members.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm sorry, this is Heather. I'm not sure when that agenda item was placed on, you know, what time frame that was, but I think that we've added something to the rule in R-426-210. Subsection B that does clarify an internship now. So I don't know if that answers the question.
So 210, let's go to 210.
And it's subsection B. And there's an entire section now that, I don't know when this became effective, given 2015, maybe, 2016?
2016.
Yeah, 16.
New rule.
What's the rule number again? I'm sorry.
It's 26210, and it's subsection B.
Page 35.
Yeah, page 35. So I don't know if there was something that needed to be added to that, or if this covers it now?
No, this covers it.
Yeah, so it's really clear, you know? Works with other trainees, a written statement. Yeah, and I know you mentioned NAU, but really, the NAU, we've always used this guideline. I think the one question we have was somebody who didn't meet the contemporaneous supervision. But we have other people that come from non-APIC internships, especially if they're out of state, that also have trouble with this requirement.
It is that.
But it is what it is, and I mean, I'm not willing to, you know. I think it's just, it's minimum standard for the profession, and you know, we want them to have a truly a internship experience, so.
And Madam Chair, committee members, this is Heather again. I'm sorry to interrupt, but there is one thing that the committee might want to consider clarifying in that section, is that the internship has to be part of the doctoral program. It's inferred, but there's nowhere that says specifically where it's stated that the internship has to be part of the doctoral program, or completed, you know, in the doctoral program. We've had a few applicants who have asked that question to us, and there, you know, there's been some back and forth with some applicants about, you know, staff is telling them that historically, it's always been included in the doctoral program, and, you know, the applicant comes back and asks us where that is in rule or statute, so I don't know if that's something the committee wants to look at.
Well, I think that would also include the pre-internships, because there are people that, applicants that were in the master's program, and they've done some training, but it's not in a doctoral type program.
So there.
Number one addresses that.
Yeah, under subsection A.
Okay.
A, it is stated very clearly that the pre-internship has to be part of that.
Oh, there it is, yes. So, you know, I guess it would be obvious it ought to be in the internship as well.
Wait a minute. The clinical psychology construct does not rule psychologists. Counseling psychology programs are split. You take a master's degree for 2 years that includes practicums, internship experiences, and you create hours that are then accepted into the doctoral program, transferred in, and those must be allowed to count. And we count them. I don't want those disqualified because their practicums were considered at a master's level.
Well, in some respects, it would appear because they're included in the doctoral program that they are, maybe doing double talk. They were accepted by their doctoral program.
Yes. Now, the second part of this is we have a major school in town, in the state, not to name anybody, the U of A, who has put people through their clinical program without having the internship on the transcript. And they say it's part of the program, you can't graduate without it, but to save students money, we don't charge them for it, so there's no course number and it's not on the transcript. I find that appalling and a violation of their accreditation. But apparently the school has the ability to do it, and even worse, we've licensed people who've gone through that way.
That's interesting, because I know there are other schools that don't charge students for internship, and they've created some kind of a zero credit class, you know? So they register for it, and they create a zero credit, and I don't know whether we have that ability in any of our three state institutions to do that zero credit. In fact, one of the things we are doing at NAU, we're just submitting paperwork, is we're going to reduce the number of credits people have to sign up for just to save them some money again, so it's getting it down to like 2 credits maximum, So they are registered, but they're going to pay less.
But so a student going on internship, say like WELO this year, is going to be registered in a class that says internship in September?
Yes.
Excellent.
He has to be. That's a liability issue, because he's still a student at NAU, and in order to get to protect the risk management requires registration.
That's what I thought. How does U of A get away with not doing it?
I wonder if the students registered for something else, so they're still...
We called the training director, we tracked it down, because we were concerned this board was going to turn his application down, and we wanted to make sure it got on the transcript, and they laughed at us.
No, that is... U of A's program, though, is APA approved?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, and I guess somewhere in their system, they wouldn't allow them to graduate without completing it, but that is weird. It would not be reflected on their transcript.
Mm-hmm. I can show you the transcript sitting here that's not on it.
I guess they're treating it like comprehensive exams, and you take a comprehensive exam, it's not on a transcript.
Right.
But it is a requirement of the program.
Exactly.
And Madam Chair, committee members, my comment was more for applicants or individuals who are completing supervised experience post-degree that they're wanting to count as an internship.
I do want to address that, and I'm glad you raised that point. I think the UFA is a kind of a separate issue and probably not totally relevant for this discussion. But I do have a concern or a suggestion, because in case we find somebody who's had the right type of degree, meaning an applied health service degree, and somehow their internship doesn't meet the requirement, or if they are a foreign graduate and their internship most likely will not meet the requirement, the medical schools allow people to redo their residency, So I know doctors from India, when they come, they are able to get credit for their coursework. And even if they've done a residency, even if they've been practicing for many years, they come here and get into a residency program and meet the residency requirement.
The odds-on thing here for us is the retreads that we do. We have multiple psychologists who get a degree in experimental psychology and then go attend another university and do a clinical retread. So after their doctorate, they take the clinical courses and go do an internship. They don't get another degree. They just have taken the retread program, and we license them.
And they're eligible to apply for even an APIC internship, correct?
Correct.
Mm-hmm. So the way our statute reads then, Heather, or rule reads, it allows us to consider those experiences.
Yes, and we should, because many people retread.
And it also gives us the option in case, you have somebody who spent 5 years in school and their APIC or their internship doesn't meet our statutory, they have that option then to
redo another internship, yes.
Mm-hmm. But it would be through a university, right?
Yes.
Dr. Bohan?
Yes.
I'm wondering, though, does our current rules say it has to be pre-doctoral on the internship?
I'm looking at pre-internship. The board shall use whether the applicant's internship or training program qualifies. It doesn't say pre-doctoral.
Okay, so that.
Written statement was established no later than they started it. The supervisor was directly available and, okay. And then I'm going to the, let me go to the statutes to make sure that it matches. I have two screens and I have both of them up on my screen. So. An applicant for licensure shall obtain 3,000 hours of supervised professional, 500 hours as an internship as described in subsection F. So, and I'm going to F, I'm just reading that. I mean, you may have, sorry if I'm being redundant. The applicant shall have 1,000 hours of supervised professional experience, which will be an internship approved by the American Psych Association, an internship as a member of the APIC, or an organized training program that is designed to provide training with a plan, program, sequence of training experiences, the focus and purpose of which are to assure breadth and quality of training. That's the statute. So.
Okay, so there's nothing about it having to be prior to the doctoral completion then?
I am looking. Though they do need interaction with doctoral trainees. Yep, there's nothing in our statute or rules. So,
sounds like there's consensus then not to make any changes to that?
Correct.
Okay. Are you okay, Ms. Heather, Ms. Broaddus?
Yeah, yeah, I just wanted to bring it to the committee's attention.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. So let's go to the reactivation of inactive license status and requirement of the same and hours of C clarification, including the memo from Dr. Johnson indicating could we eliminate the required hours in domestic violence, abuse, you know, bullying, et cetera.
What's
so Dr. Flowers, do you want to give us a brief summary?
Well, as I've said at a previous meeting, I think that the CUs for people who have been inactive for more than 2 years is unclear.
Okay.
And I think at some point the board interpreted that as every time there's a renewal cycle, even if it's 10 years after the person has inactive, that they would just prorate from the beginning of that one cycle and complete the proportional hours of CEUs. But to me, it would make sense to indicate that if it's 2 years or longer, that the person wanting to reactivate would give 40 hours of CEU proof that meet the requirements.
Okay, so where would you suggest language change?
Oh, okay. Well, right now, under renewal, the rule 426-206, it would be B. What I suggest would be we put down a psychologist who is on inactive status for 2 years or longer may reinstate the license to active status by presenting to the board completion of at least 40 hours of CE that meet the requirements of the rule. And then it goes on to say those that have been on inactive for less than 2 years can do the proportional. And I think that would cover it. I mean, as
so
far as I'm concerned.
So do we have to remove the word at least? Just a completion of 40 hours?
Well, we could put, 40 hours or more, or I guess.
No, why would it be more? Because 40 hours is the maximum.
Okay, well, if you want to put some extra in, fine, kind of thing. But we don't have to have the at least. We could just say completion of 40 hours. I mean, that was
okay.
Could be the same thing. Certainly, if they have extra, we're not going to say, no, you need to give us a.
Yeah, we're not going to say no, yeah.
So
Ms. Jones and Ms. Hahn, so if we can remove those two words, at least.
At least before 40 hours of CE, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. I read at least two years to be the same as 2 years or more. Do you disagree?
Oh, okay.
Well, what's happened, though, is when, well, you've seen me do it on some of the board meetings, somebody who's been in active status for maybe 4 years, if they just reinstated their inactive status 2 months ago, they only have to give like 2 months worth proportionally of CEs. And it was like I was puzzled because if they had wanted to reactivate 3 months earlier, they would have needed essentially the 40 hours. But since they waited till the renewal cycle, they didn't do that. And strictly speaking, if they went inactive or had the inactive status like the same month they want to be reactivated, they have to give no CUs at all.
I thought they had to. If so, if I've been inactive for 2 years and on September, which is my birth month, I apply for reactivation, I have to show CUs for the previous 2 years.
Well, I think what happens is the way that I read it, or not read it, but understood it, would be you'd have to have proof of those that previous 2 years as if you were still active the whole time, but only you'd only have to submit the information if audited. And I forget which case it was. It's been a few months or longer where there was something in the consent agenda about somebody wanting to go back on active status, and I had the board pull it out, look at it, and I said, I'm confused. This person has been inactive for, I forget how many years, and we're only asking like for 4 or 5 hours of CEs. And I said, well, then.
Maybe Ms. Broadus can, do you recall that?
So I think what Dr. Flowers is referring to is if a licensee is on inactive status, let's say for 6 years, and their birthday is mm-hmm. in March, and they go on inactive status again in March, but then come May, June, or July, they go for reactivation of their license, then we start from the beginning of the renewal period. So
I think that's a wrong interpretation. Mm-hmm.
That's not reading.
Yeah, that is a wrong. I thought they had to do at least 40.
Well, I would think so, but again, it's been a while. I think Dr. Brundage had said, mm-hmm. well, these requirements, and it was like just a handful of CUs after like 4 or 5 years, and I thought, well.
Yeah,
and
to
then
me,
they,
people were, mm-hmm. That's a loophole.
On numerous and I occasions, think, we have taken applicants who are off having babies and raising children and took 3, 4, 5, 6 years off, came before us, and we've asked them to do 40 CEs and develop a plan to catch up. We've literally had those on several occasions where we've created that type of request.
Okay, I guess I wasn't in the board at the time.
Yeah, my thought is that inactive status should not excuse the continuing education requirement, so that if you're inactive, you're not practicing, you're still learning. And I think that we should hold people and be clear with people that when they go on inactive status, that does not excuse them from the continuing education requirement.
Madam Chair, committee members, Paragraph B does state that if someone is on inactive for less than 2 years, they can reinstate for a prorated amount of CE, but that's less than 2 years. I don't think the wording at any point says, because the first line of the same set of the rule says, if they're out for at least 2 years, they've got to do that 40 CE.
Right.
So. I think we've had a misinterpretation, and we can certainly address that without changing the rule.
I agree.
That was my understanding, so that one, does puzzle me. It, you know, I mean, the kind part of the statute or rule is if you've been out, as Dr. Bohansky just, you know, gave examples of 6 years, we don't make them do 120. We just do the last 2 years, you know.
Which would be the 40, yes. That makes
the
sense,
40.
And that's what your rules
so
are.
So it's always 40, even if they reinstate in, I mean, to me, it would be 40, and then because they reinstated in, say, April, no, say June, so that's, so then they'll come up for renewal again in March, then in March, they would need to do the prorated amount of how long they were licensed. So from June to March, you know, they would get possibly 10-hour, that would be 30 hours. You
but
see
only,
what I mean?
Only if
because
they've been out less than 2 years.
Right. No, no, no. I'm talking about when they come up for renewal on their newly activated license, because then the period that they're licensed is 18 months, not, you see what I mean?
Years.
Yeah.
Not
when,
2 years.
They reactivate, if they've been gone more than 2 years, when they reactivate, they have to get 40 hours. And if they reactivate in the middle of a licensing period, then the next renewal, they have to get the prorated.
That's correct. That's you stating it
right.
Much better. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes, that makes much more sense. But there was some confusion. I don't know if that needs to be brought up as a board agenda.
Okay,
item.
I think we can put it as an item because in my mind, Mike, I think it was always the 40. There was no prorated,
okay.
You know, yeah. And
okay.
I think that might have been an anomaly, so.
Okay,
so.
Yeah, I just was, you might say, cognitively agitated when that came up, so.
Yeah, I can see that, yeah.
But
okay, we don't need to change the language
okay.
then.
It was just, maybe just the application needs to be tweaked. Or whatever, we just need to bring it up and have a common agreement among board members so that when that occurs in the future, there'll be consistency.
And maybe, Ms. Jones, if we can clearly, you know, as part of even this minutes of this meeting, you know, capture this discussion for future reference.
Yes, ma'am.
And just another thing that came up during that, like, full board meeting was, the presumption is well, a lot of these other people have active licenses elsewhere. And so they're saying, what I was told as well, they probably did it with their other states. And, well, okay, great. Where's the documentation?
And
but,
that's correct.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't matter. We're
going to
request 40.
Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, this is Heather. I just wanted to clarify that when this new rule became effective, board staff did consult with Ms. Galvin on the application and interpretation of it, so maybe she could be included in the discussion at the board meeting.
Okay.
Definitely.
Okay.
Yeah, that would be very helpful.
Okay.
We're giving her a day off.
Okay. As far as the domestic violence request from Dr. Johnson, my comment on that was that I recommend denial because any client may present information that could require mandated reporting or needs for other intervention, regardless of whether the initial or the original purpose of the assessment or the interview is psychodiagnostic assessment. And I think that would be a reason to maintain the requirement.
I think the other reason to maintain it, I think we are mandated by state law to have it, so it's not really in our purview. Yeah.
Okay, I didn't. I knew the reporting requirements.
All health, I think, yeah.
But
isn't that correct? Dr. Bohansky, that's my recollection of those CEs.
No, I don't think it's mandated by state law.
Oh, you don't? Oh.
Well, I think, yeah, the mandated reporting is, but not the CEs.
I somehow thought some organization lobbied and asked for at least behavioral health professionals to have that.
Yeah, could be, but...
That was my understanding. That's the reason I've been given. And maybe we can ask Attorney General to clarify that.
Yeah, I think the way they did it was to change our rules. I don't think that there was a separate statute that impacts on all health professions.
Madam Chair, committee members, we can certainly investigate that.
Okay.
But it's, I think, just kind of a prudent idea, even if there's no law for it. But, yeah, but if there is certainly a mandate from the state, a law, that's even more of a reason.
Well, what we got to be careful of is there's a lot of things that we feel touched in our heart by that we could require people to have to get training every 2 years in. California's got half a dozen because they're constantly coming up with another issue. We want to be careful that we all know child abuse is an incredibly important thing, but quite frankly, so is opioid addiction, and so is human trafficking, and you can just run down the list, LGBTQ, and on and on and on and on. And I don't like mandating political expediency.
Well, yes, at some point there's a line that needs to be drawn. We don't require every 2 years that we attend a class telling us not to have sex with clients. It's simply there in the code of ethics.
As is much of this other topics, which is why ethics is always required in every jurisdiction. But to then start adding this topic and my favorite topic and your favorite topic and what have you as mandated, it gets wearing a little thin.
So that could be debated. I'm not sure the history of it, but having worked in domestic abuse for many years, I guess I'm just used to preaching that topic. But indeed, that could be looked at and see if it's a requirement by some kind of rule, well, not rule, but some kind of law that we were mandated by the state. If so, then difficult to change that.
And that's what this came up from Dr. Pat Johnson at a legislative committee meeting of ASPA last year or the year before, and she asked the board to consider the change, and she gave the history of how this association had lobbied the board to make this change, and that quite frankly, a good number of the senior psychologists have been doing this every year after year after year, and quite frankly, there's no new information, and they're tired of having to do the same thing every year, and they just as soon we consider dropping it.
Well, I'm in actually in favor of it, but I'd like to make sure. I mean, I just checked the Behavioral Health Board, and they don't have it. They have another CE requirement. They have cultural. They have 3 hours of ethics, and then they have cultural diversity as required.
Yeah, there's cultural another competency. Politically correct topic.
Yeah, so they don't have domestic violence or abuse as mandatory CEUs. So
I think we should mandate wine tasting.
So I think it needs to be, this is a discussion, maybe we should add it to the agenda, and maybe Ms. Galvin can advise us whether, you know, just to make sure that, because I mean, my recollection is just based on some memory, so, you know, I'd like to make sure that there's nothing out there.
Madam Chair, committee members, we can certainly research that and bring it back to the committee.
Okay.
Is one of our stakeholders coming to us and saying we'd like this changed? When it was a stakeholder that came to us and said we want it put in, and now perhaps it's run its course.
So I think it's worthy of inviting the stakeholders who have wanted this to be removed to come forth. I was at that discussion at that meeting, and I can recall them coming up with half a dozen other things they said would be more timely or topic relevant to practice. And I think we should listen.
And Ms. Jones, I don't know if this is too much to ask, but is it possible, and I'm thinking you have minutes on file going back to a long time.
7 years.
I wonder when this became effective. Is it possible to find that out? And, you
absolutely.
Know, I would be really curious about, huh?
Yes.
The rule went into effect in 2016.
No, no, no. It's been around since I've been
yeah.
a psychologist. we might have clarified it in rule, but it's not, it's been around for a long time. And then bullying was added in somewhere in the last few years, because some people were doing bullying credits and they said, can that count as abuse? And so then the board decided yes, so we added that. So, but that was the only addition. This has been around for a long time, probably before 2006. So
yeah, we added bullying because it was a form of abuse.
Yeah,
yes.
But that was the only change we made. So I'm thinking, I have no idea when it came.
Yeah, I don't remember. I remember the days where we didn't have to submit any CUs. We just had to make sure we didn't commit crimes. You know, it was different.
But all of us would do the bullying and child abuse. But I don't think it was before 90. I'm thinking it was in the last 15 years. So. But that's a big, big burden, I know.
Yeah.
So I don't know how.
I've maintained my CU records for probably the last 15 years. I could probably just look back and see what I can find.
That's hoarding.
It is. It's got electronic and paper anal retentiveness.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you could just do a word search and see when you started including abuse and domestic violence. Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair, we can certainly research that and try to get you a date.
Yeah. I mean, I'm curious about what sparked making those specific requirements. We all remember, Dr. Bohensky and I remember very well the bullying discussion, so we don't need to worry about that. But the child abuse and the other...
partner and domestic violence and vulnerable adults. I mean, there are lots of topics in there that have been acceptable or added into this requirement over time.
Well, I think ethics and abuse came at about the same time.
Yeah. I almost want to say, you know, the more I'm thinking about it, 1998, 99,
yeah.
That's kind of the time frame.
I think you're right.
Because I can almost see the statute in writing.
I think for a while we were just resisting having to do any CUs. You know, why do we have to do this? And then the requirements for specifics were added later.
So, Ms. Jones, the older statutes, you know, pre-revisions, do we have all of that on file somewhere?
Yes, it would be in the records.
Okay, because I think when we see the change in the rules, or change, you know, because I remember that being added, and...
There could be board meetings or minutes from back in the day.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to be, you know, that's a lot of minutes to look at, so.
We'll do our best.
Okay. Let's come back to that, because I'm really open to considering Dr. Johnson's request. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, committee members, in the interest of time, because we did only schedule this for 2 hours. I think that addresses all the questions that we had of specific items. May we ask Ms. Hant if she has any questions regarding the five-year rule review that she needs assistance with?
Please.
Oh, sorry.
Your materials are incorporated by reference. They've been updated. I mean, there are updated versions available. Shall we address that? If we eventually do a rulemaking, shall we update your materials?
Yes. Some of them. I don't want to update the APA Code of Ethics reference.
Well, that's the one I have circled here. You have a 2003
yes.
version. It's been updated to 2016.
Don't want that.
Okay.
The board made a specific request not to because of certain changes, and unless APA were to change that, we will continue to operate under the 2003.
Correct.
Okay. The thing I asked.
It's a military psychology issue.
Okay, no problem. I just need to get an answer. So are you having any other difficulties enforcing your rules? Have you received any information that suggests that the rules are having an economic impact you didn't anticipate?
There's one question I had on some of that, and I'm not really sure if it's just my difficulties reading through the rules, but when I read about reapplying for license and applying anew for license.
Yep.
I had to read it a number of times to figure out what is what. I don't know if applicants are having that same issue. Been a while since I applied, so I don't know.
Yeah, I remember writing that with
Ms.
Oldley. Yeah, right.
Okay, because when I see reapplication for license and then applying anew, I thought, well, what on earth's the difference? It's the same thing. And then reading through all the stuff, I still wasn't sure. And then I wrote down what I considered my definitions. You know, reapplying allows the applicant to update existing application materials. But then I guess applying anew means you redo everything. Is that a correct interpretation?
Yes, they have to submit. I think when they apply anew, they have to meet, I don't know. I think both have to meet the current statute. Is that correct,
Well, that's my understanding.
Well, mm-hmm. The rule lists who has to do which. Is that not clear?
Well, I'm just wondering, to me it's not clear, but I'm not applying. So I'm just wondering if customers are confused with that or if the people reapplying or applying anew have difficulties figuring that one out.
Not in trouble?
Not to my knowledge, and I think that this was clarified in rule.
For I guess they can look through it and figure it out then. Okay.
Yeah, for people who have not passed the national exam, and they've taken it three times, that it clarifies that they have to apply anew, and it also clarifies that we only keep,
actually, that's not true. A person may reapply if they fail the national exam.
Less than.
No more than three times, right? If it's three times or more, then they have to do anew.
Correct.
Right, okay. And you just have to read subsections A and D very carefully and find out where you fit.
And I think that there was confusion, too, with how long we can reuse documentation. So this rule clarifies that.
Okay, so long as the applicants can figure that one out. That's the key thing. I think once you're licensed and curious, as I am, then if you're confused, it doesn't make any difference.
And maybe if you can't figure it out,
you shouldn't be licensed.
The problem.
Well, you know, I know when I review applications, the stuff is there for me to look at, so somehow it's working.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess there's no need to fix it. If it's not broken, there's no need to try to fix it.
Yeah. So do we have time to briefly review Article 1, 2, and 2 that, you know, we divided amongst ourselves to review more carefully?
Absolutely. As much help as I can get is appreciated.
Okay. Dr. Bohansky.
Present.
Which article did you
read? Do you want to make any suggestion for Article 1? Do you see any changes necessary?
Yeah, I'm just looking back through.
Okay, that's fine. Just making sure you're okay.
Well, that's a debatable thing most days, but... the piece that I think we have to pay attention to as a result of our sunset evaluation are the fees. In our 426-108.
What's the issue with them?
Well, we have to justify our fees, I guess, or we should be paying attention to that issue.
But we're not aware that they're inappropriate at this time.
Yeah. I'm not saying we change it. I'm just saying that we've been called to look at it.
And we will.
And we need to look at it because it's in the sunset report, and we're going to have a response on that. And I think these two things go hand in hand. My question on telepractice is, do we want to put into rule anything about the compact, which goes into effect next year?
We don't know. Oh, 2020, you're right. I'm sorry, yes.
Yeah, because we're not talking about rule changes now. We're talking about rule changes in a year from now. In a year from now, the SciPac will be in effect. And is that going to require us changing our rules? Because administratively, we're going to have to appoint a commissioner, as we're one of the original seven, who is going to write the SciPac rules, and then we're going to have to incorporate them at least by reference into our rule package, I'm assuming.
That sounds a ways off. They're going to write theirs next year, right?
No, it's already happening.
Oh, it is.
It's going to go into effect.
Next year.
They haven't started yet.
Officially.
Oh, okay.
Can't start officially until the commission is formed and we appoint commissioners. But you're going to need an administrative staff and a legal staff who has been working on this for the past 2 years. When the commissioners come in, they'll be assigned to write it, and what they'll essentially do is approve it. That's the way most of this stuff works. The only thing that I would add in here is, or question in here, is on 426.11. Do we want to maintain the 50% of supervision, or can we be more flexible with that? Stakeholders have come to us on numerous occasions and asked for that to be at least 75%, especially for folks in rural areas.
I don't know. We were 25%, if you remember, Dr. Bohensky, and then
yes,
we went up to 50%.
Yes.
So that's only half of the supervision. 75% means the majority of supervision could be done by professionals other than psychologists.
Oh, not other than psychologists, but via telepractice. We don't have a provision.
Oh, 75%. Oh, okay, okay. I see what you're saying.
75% of the supervision.
Yeah.
It still has to be provided by a licensee.
Correct. It's still
provided. Oh, yeah. Okay. Sorry. I was, because we've also, the 75% is still in effect for the type of supervisor.
So if I'm supervising psychology interns up in Kingman and Bullhead City, and I get up there a fourth of the time and see them personally, can the other consultations and scheduled supervisions be provided via a telemed system we have, which makes that a heck of a lot more immediate and convenient? And we turn around and recognize that that's what our medical professionals are doing, and in fact, a good number of patients, their total sessions are done that way.
I'm okay with that, but I think we definitely need to get, we definitely need to run it by the full, take it as a recommendation to the board.
Yes.
And
yes, sir.
Madam Chair, committee members, this is Heather. I think that it's in statute under postdoc and internship how much supervision can be provided via electronic means. So I don't know if that would require statute change.
The Jeannie question.
We'll have to check into it.
Okay.
And that's pretty much all the comments I had on section one.
Yeah, it is in statute. It says not more than 50% of the in-person supervision. I think, why don't we just go ahead and have the discussion, even if it's not a rule change, and we don't have to do it at the very next meeting, maybe at the next in-person meeting. And if there's a, you know, and if the board is supportive, then the next time we open statutes, or you know, that could be a change that could be added then if we get support.
That could be next week.
That could be. Mm-hmm. Okay. In Article 2, I had one question, and it's R4-26-202E. It was brought to, I mean, I was reading the rules, and I think this came up as a discussion at our last board meeting, and then, and it's clarified in rule, and so I want to bring your attention to this, and I also want to bring up the statute and see if you think it's a problem. So 26202, so let me go to that page, 202E. Okay, so it's on page 14. And then if you look at ARS, and I'll read you ARS 8.4. So in ARS 8.4, let
sorry, I'm trying to find it.
It's the subsection that says that the core program has to include courses in certain subject areas, such as...
Yeah, so that's page 7. So I just want to read this and see if you see a problem. A core program that requires each student to demonstrate competence by passing suitable comprehensive exams or by successfully completing at least 3 or more graduate semester hours, the quarter, trimester, or by other suitable means in the following content areas. And the question that I'm focusing on is the by passing suitable comprehensive exams. And then when you go to the rule, it says the board shall count a course or comprehensive exam only once. Is that a problem? Will someone challenge us based on our statutes that doesn't specify?
Well, heaven knows you can be challenged. But what I understand that to mean, and if you have a question, then maybe it's not clearly written, is that a class in ethics can be counted as a class in ethics, but may not also be counted as a class in research design. You got to choose. This class is either ethics or it's research design. And if you have an examination in that class, it can only be counted as one comprehensive examination. It can't be counted as an examination in ethics as well as research design. Does that make any sense?
It does. I guess here's where my concern is, and I wasn't so much focusing on the course portion of the rule.
Okay.
I was focusing on the comprehensive exam of the rule.
Mm-hmm.
So technically, based on our statute and the rule, as you explained it so well, you could really meet all the coursework requirements by just passing a comprehensive exam. Is that correct? Different comprehensive exams, without having completed any coursework.
Certainly not the way I read it, nor is that what it says. Demonstrate by passing or by six. You're right. The statute says you don't have to take any classes. You can just pass an
exam.
Right?
And I only realized that last month when we, or not even last month, earlier this month at our board meeting. Wow, I didn't know the comprehensive exam was written so broadly, technically meaning somebody could just do a big comprehensive exam and bypass all the coursework.
My interpretation of that was that there's just one of these courses you didn't complete, that if your comprehensive specialty exam included everything, you could just say, well, it's in there. But I hadn't read it as like, well, don't worry about taking any core courses. Just take a big test and ace it.
But I don't know. The more I read it, the more I think, somebody could.
It's not really clear on that. And
yeah.
I could see that now, yeah.
It allows...
Yeah, so it just kind of raised some alarm for me. We've never had that happen.
Just take the EPPP and don't worry about going to grad school.
No, no, no. That's post-degree. The institution has to give, the degree-granting institution has to give the exam. And that's
definitely.
That's the British mentorial system. If you look at getting a doctoral degree in psychology from traditional English system university, that's what you would end up with.
You don't have coursework, and I mean, that's the way it was in India.
Yes,
that's
the British system. You don't have coursework, you have a comprehensive.
Well, and I think that's why it's good to have the rule to clarify that it can only count for one requirement, satisfaction of one requirement versus...
But you could have a comprehensive exam in each of those areas and never have to take a course.
Correct.
And I guess, hearing y'all, that information, I guess I'm just thinking of my own graduate training where the comprehensive exam covered anything, any course area for the graduate training, rather than a final exam for a course would be comprehensive over the specific course. So I don't know if there's lack of clarity for that on that, on what this is saying.
The way I've seen applicants submit their comprehensive exams, and I know how we do it at NAU, we say the person has completed a comprehensive exam in research and stats and ethics and vocational, and, you know, these are the areas covered.
Is it one exam for all, or is it like several?
I mean, it's a comprehensive exam, so, I mean, it's a 12-hour exam they take, you know, and they cover all these different topics.
Okay, and that's tradition. That's what I went through, 2 days of, you might say, purging everything I knew.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had sealed envelopes.
I mean, it's not been an issue, but I just wanted to, when I started reading it and comparing to the statute, it just caused me a little, I cringed. It's not been an issue in the law.
Do we need a substantive
statement? So how do you think we should change the rule to make sure that it's, or should we just take out subsection E?
I mean, the rule is fine. It matches the statute. It's really the statute that is more, that is the concern. So, I mean, to me, it should be people should do courses, period. Comprehensive exams may be used, you know, in no more than two areas, you know, to meet, satisfy the requirement or something. But I think for now, my sense is I think we need to leave that alone because the curriculum is changing so much in the whole psychology world that at some point we probably have to look at a statute change, you know. So I think for now, you know, really it requires a statute change for what I'm referring to, not so much a rule change. So, but if we are going to address coursework and, you know, in statute, that's a whole different discussion. So,
it's a major discussion.
So for now, I think we need to put it on the list, you know, for statutory revisions, you know, but I think we can move ahead with the rule. That was really my only, the other question that I had got addressed by the application, you know, was in the next section. So I'm fine.
I just like a little clarification, please. You know, we made the change of deleting much of the detail in Rule 203. But you have you have other application rules that have the same problem. 205C, for example.
And that would be the
And so I'm just
renewal.
Asking for your authorization to make the same change whenever I encounter it. Or to suggest.
Okay, I'm fine with that.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, so it goes, I'm looking at page 21. We'll go right up to page 22, right before R426, that's 204 examination.
Right. Well, we need to.
That's a temporary license.
It's 205
renewals.
205C primarily.
Mm-hmm. Basically, anytime it says they shall complete the application form,
if
it has a list underneath it, you remove it and just say as approved by the board.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, and then we go into the next section, Dr. Flowers, 2426-207.
Let me pull up there as far as the renewals. Let's see. Other than the items I've mentioned, I didn't really see any concerns.
So I'm wondering if you go to C, R4-26205C, I'm wondering whether we should use the same logic. To renew a license, a license shall submit to the board a renewal and change it to an approved renewal application form as approved by the board, which is available from the board office and on its website and the attestation thing, and period. Do we need to include all that personal information about the applicant, address, telephone number?
If that's on the form, then that would be consistent to just state that, as you were saying, that just as approved by the board.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You would keep 5, which it says, this is on page 26, the license status for which the application is made, you know, active. And the following information about continuing education completed, which is 6, do we need that A, B, C, D, E? They would just put it on the form, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, committee members, we would make the changes to R426-205 similar to the ones we did on the initial application.
Okay.
Good.
Okay, and then on page 29, where we talk about the different CEs under D, I hope that we don't make any changes. I have fond memories of going through this with Dr. Bohansky a few years ago. And I know the public, our stakeholders really appreciate having all it delineated so clearly.
Yes.
Well, it appears to be working, so there's no need to change it other than we might address the issue on the domestic violence, but we're already planning to do that.
I had a question for Ms. Broaddus in terms of the timeline. For reviewing applications, are we doing okay in terms of meeting all the guidelines as yeah. per rule?
Yes.
Okay.
There is one issue that was brought up by the auditors in the time frames, and that is whenever an applicant is approved to sit for the ECPP, there's no indication in the rule that application is going to be closed. So the substantive review may include that 1-year period, which would make us outside of our time frame. So that's something that the committee should discuss, including, you know, the substantive review time frame, or putting that in the table is ended when it's been approved by the board.
Okay. But then,
you know, we still allow the applicant the 1 year to sit for the exam.
Or simply, the time to respond is extended so that it includes a year.
Or, yeah, what Jeannie Hahn just said.
We would ask
if you want to, go ahead.
I'm sorry. Madam Chair, committee members, we would ask that the board allow us to address that change so it would also meet the auditor's requirement.
I agree.
Yep, we agree. That was the same thing I was going to say, so. Okay.
Madam Chair, if we could just ask Ms. Han, do you have any other questions or need for clarification on items?
Not at the moment. Heaven knows I may later, but not at the moment.
So maybe once all these recommendations have been addressed and we have a, you know, a kind of a track change copy, we could have another meeting, maybe, would you say, in the month of April?
Actually, we're,
is that insufficient?
We're working on two things at the moment. Well, one thing, and we're thinking about the second. The first is just getting this report done. And the report will serve as a plan of work for rulemaking.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, we've worked on rulemakings before, so you understand they take a long time, or they can take a long time. So the first thing is to get the report done. I have a substantial amount of it done. Today has been very helpful. I will make it as detailed as possible so that it actually serves as a plan of work. And then sometime in the future, we'll start on the rulemaking once you get authorized to do so.
Okay.
So the game plan from here would be to complete the five-year rule review, submit that, get through that process, and then we'll submit the request to the governor's office for the exemption to the rulemaking moratorium, and then we would open a rule package at that point and move forward with the changes.
Okay, and somewhere I'm hoping in your report that we, if it's appropriate, but that we make a statement that we are aware of, you know, being concise, and we have taken out many, many pages. We are recommending the removal.
Right.
Which I hope will endear us to the governor's office.
Absolutely. We'll brag about it.
Okay, thank you. Is there anything else, Dr. Bohansky and Dr. Flowers, that you think we need to address?
No, ma'am, but I would like to pick up the receiver and chat with you for a second after we close the meeting.
Okay. I'll be glad to do that. Go ahead.
I'm sorry, this is Heather again. I'm sorry to interrupt. There, it sounded like you thoroughly reviewed Article 2 pertaining to licensure, continuing education. So I just wanted to point to the committee that the committee might want to look at clarifying whether a temporary licensed person, at this point, they can sit for the EPP, but we don't have any procedures in place for them in a rule. So we've just kind of adopted how we handle psychologists, not, you know, and have applied that to temporary licensed people. So I don't know if that's something that the committee wants to look at in the future. You know, at this point.
Well, so I have one recommendation. Is it possible to take some of the rule language that applies to psychologists and insert it for temporary licenses, and then when we look at the substantive document for changes, we will review it at that time? That makes sense, what you're saying? And so add that to the rules, or even make reference, you know, to a previous section. Does that help?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It's just, it's really unclear at this point, you know, temporary licensed people that are already licensed, so they don't have to submit a reapplication. But we might want to...
Especially if they fail an exam, correct?
Right, yeah, so we might want to look at putting in some sort of a procedure and rule for that.
Okay.
We can certainly...
I'm open to, you know, kind of some draft language, and then we can look at it, so.
Yay.
yes, whatever is consistent with what's done with a regular psychologist would sure be a lot simpler.
Yeah. And what you're kind of currently practicing, Ms. Broaddus, you know, so using your experience would really help us too.
Okay. Thanks.
So. Sounds good. We do have some agenda items. I know that we've recommended at least to the full board. And so, you know, and
But for now, we will wait to hear from Ms. Jones and Ms. Pond regarding our next steps. But I appreciate everybody's due diligence to reviewing the rules. I think, you know, we may, you know, recommended some good changes that will help our stakeholders and clarify things that are less clear. So really appreciate everyone's work on this committee, including all of you, Ms. Jones, Ms. Hahn, and Ms. Broaddus. Great work, good teamwork. So appreciate that.
Thank you.
Moving to the next item is a call for adjournment. Do I hear a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
I second.
All in favor say aye.
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 I'll call you on your cell phone, Dr.
Oh, okay.
Bohansky.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.